So in this episode, we're talking to Natasha Chaplow. She's one of the alumni from Alice Smith School. Now she's working in Washington in climate change and disaster risk management. Let's get into this episode right now.
This is the Alice Smith Pod on Purpose podcast, your globally available brain booster, and you can listen everywhere, even during lunch break. Join us as we chat with game changers, education rock stars, and worldly explorers.
Natasha, thank you for being here and welcome to this episode of the podcast. How are you today?
Hi, Simon. Thanks for having me. I'm doing well.
Good. It's great to talk to you. Just tell us, first of all, where in the world you are. Where are you coming to us from today?
So I'm currently based in Washington, D.C.
Okay. And Washington, so what time of day is it there with you right now?
It's almost 11:15 with me.
11:15 a.m. What's Washington like at this time of year? We're recording this in the middle of March.
So to me, it's quite surprising. I spend a lot of time in England. That's where I'm originally from, in the very northern part where it's very cold. So at this time of year, it's a lot warmer than I usually expect it to be. It was around 23 degrees earlier this week. So it's pretty much in what would be an English summer for me at this time of year. And it's nice now because it's light again up until kind of 7:30. So the days are drawing out. It's kind of my favorite time of the year, really, when you able to do a lot more, and it's just in between. It's not freezing cold, but it's not too warm that you can't really go outside like in Malaysia, where it's, you know, you have to kind of get inside the air conditioning.
So I love the way that you mentioned this is one of your favorite times of the year. People often say that in the US people tend to be quite positive, optimistic kinds of people. Do you find that to be the case? And if so, how do you see that compares to people in the UK and people in Malaysia as well?
That's an interesting one, because I think with the type of work I do, working in international development, I'm surrounded by a lot of multicultural people, and they're not actually based in DC, most of the people I interact with. In terms of comparing people from the US to the UK, the only thing I can really say about it is from the time I spent in California when I was studying for my PhD, I'd interact with a lot of people over there, and I definitely noticed there were some big cultural barriers. I was actually pretty surprised, because coming from Malaysia, there's this huge language barrier, which you would expect. But when I moved over to the US, I was thinking, well, we all speak the same language, so this should be fine. And then to see that the cultural divide was sometimes even wider than the language barrier, was alarming sometimes, if I'm being honest. But it was also pretty funny. I mean, even ordering things like water, they can't understand my accent. And I mean, I miss this most of all, the sense of humor, being from the north of England, where arguably, you know, the best sense of humor is.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely.
I miss that a ton when I'm out in America. So yeah, I think that's the main things for me that I really notice, the sense of humor, and they're absolutely shocking drivers.
Okay. All right. And then before we talk about Alice Smith School for a moment, where in the north of England are you from then?
I'm originally from outside of Newcastle, so northern part, Morpeth. It's really kind of very close to the border town up near the Scottish border. So yeah, pretty much as far north as you can get, really.
Yeah, that really is north. Absolutely right. Okay, just for the sake of people listening, I wondered, Natasha, if you could tell us when you were at Alice Smith School, how old you were when you started and how old you were when you left there?
If I believe correctly, I was about 8 years old or 7 when I moved out. So I joined in what would be around year 4, and then I left all the way through sixth form. So 12 to 13, I completed out there and really only left to go to university. So I'd have been 18, 19 at the time, yeah.
Okay, right, got it. And then when you left the school, did you leave there and go straight to working in Washington? Maybe if you can give us a bit of a summary of what you did after you left school.
Sure. So I spent from 8 years old all the way through to 18 at Alice Smith. And then after that, I was looking to go straight to university. But actually, I really didn't get the grades that I wanted to go into the university that I wanted to. Now, I think there was a lot of pressure to go Russell Group top 25, for those who aren't familiar with what that is. And that was really interesting for me. It was disappointing in some ways. I think I put too much stock into it, really. And then not getting the grades, I didn't really just want to go to university for the sake of it at that point. So I actually took a gap year after I finished Alice Smith. During that gap year, it was great, because I left university actually incredibly shy. And I think there was a lot of things I still needed to learn. In that sense, I was a bit concerned that going to university, I wouldn't really be where I wanted to be personally, in order to be in that environment. and therefore I wouldn't get the most out of it. So I spent that gap year targeting that. If I'm so shy, what are the things I can do to get out of that? And one of those big things was I wanted to work and really understand, you know, if all of this fell away, like university and my education, would I still have a place kind of in the world, and would I be able to support myself and those types of things? So it was really interesting for me to decide, okay, this whole year of time, how do I make it count? But also, how do I really have an experience at the same time? So I chose to do a snowboard season because I love snowboarding. And I was actually working as a nanny out there in the Three Valleys, specifically Courchevel in France. And I worked out there for a few months, and that helped me get out of my shell, just moving to a different country, which arguably had done before with my parents as expats, as so many are who go to Alice Smith. But this was really doing it alone and for my own job, which in some ways was, I was a very proud moment for me to do a move across country for myself. And then after that, I actually finished out and loved it, going snowboarding, doing the nanny job. But then I went to work in Asda for the rest of the year until I started at university again. And then I actually really had an idea of what I wanted to do and started to think, okay, well, I don't really care about the Russell Group system anymore, to be honest. I'm passionate about obviously getting an education, going to university, but I like to say that Russell Groups, I think, really like people to be at B already. But I think that the kind of polytechnics and the lower ranked ones are very concerned about taking students from A to B. So I have a lot of admiration and respect for those universities as well. As that doesn't mean I don't respect the Russell Groups, but I view them to me very much as equals, to be honest. And I'm so proud to have been at Plymouth University when I chose to go there at the end through clearing, which again isn't the desired way many people would want to go, but that's exactly the way that I got into that university, through clearing. And then I took geology, and that was because I wanted to do something more science-based than geography. And I also then opted for ocean science, which was purely because I was so worried I'd be bored just taking geology. And that was a really, really defining moment kind of in my career trajectory, actually, because it was that decision to do geology and ocean science, which is actually a double degree. So my schedule was twice as busy as everyone else's because they were separate. You would do geology or oceanography, and rarely would people take the two. So my course was only six of us, and we essentially would just do this really packed schedule. But by the time we graduated, we came out with such an edge, which wasn't really apparent when I chose it. I didn't really know fully what I was doing in that moment. And I think that's where being really, I guess, true to yourself comes into play, because that was really in keeping with how I am now, wanting to be involved in many different things and to understand them. And that really carries through in every aspect of my career, and is really what got me where I am today, just that decision and also that kind of personality trait, I'd say. Yeah.
Natasha, it's really interesting hearing this because, you know, I think that a lot of students these days tend to feel like, you know, you mentioned about Russell Group, they tend to feel like taking the recognized path, if I can call it that, is the guaranteed way to success. But it strikes me that you're kind of, you started out your career immediately as soon as you left Alice Smith by carving out your own space and your own future the way that you wanted to do it. And if that meant not going to a Russell Group, if that meant going to Courchevel to do skiing or snowboarding, great place to do it, by the way, if that meant working in Asda, which, for the sake of anyone listening who doesn't know Asda, it's a large grocery store in the UK, if that's doing that in order to find what your absolute, you know, clear destiny path is, then I think there's a lot to say for that.
Yeah, I mean, when I think back on it, it's actually such a favorite kind of memory of mine to see how this all fell into place, because really, I think a lot of schools, and that makes sense, the education system itself is looking at kind of a very university focus. And like you're saying, this linear path. In my case, it was so important to me. I wanted to do something that mattered, definitely, but so does everyone. So saying that and actually getting that is a huge, huge leap. And I think that when you ask for these things, it's not about, you know, what degree you're going to get. I think I was very concerned about making sure that I had the right skill set and I was the correct person that would be ready for the type of work I was asking for. So that's why now on the flip side of that, when my days are difficult at work, I don't get too stressed about it because I got everything I asked for. And I think that's the way to look at it. So I spent most of my career, let's say, preparing and making sure I was the person that was able to handle and face the type of responsibility and the type of even technical, because I'm a technical expert, so the type of technical questions that I'll get as a scientist. And that's the most important thing. And I do really like to really impress that when I speak in schools and kind of emphasize it a lot because it's a very unusual thing. I think people still don't really do that enough in schools at the moment and focus on, I know that there is a focus on soft skills, but really, and just not because, you know, that the universities find it attractive or your employer finds it attractive, because it's going to help you and it's really going to set you apart. And I think the unspoken thing between school and the workplace is the fact that by the time you get to the workplace, being sincere but also very having a strong sense of self is completely valued and very rare in the workplace. So that's what I say to people to really work on
these soft skills. I'd love to do an entire podcast episode with you talking about these, but time's going to be slightly against us on that. Natasha, you mentioned geology and ocean science. Tell me a bit more about that. What's that all about?
So the way I say it, if I just look at what I do as a scientist now in my everyday work, I spend my time tying together how the ocean and the land connect. And if you have a good understanding of how the ocean and the land connect, you can also tie in how the atmosphere connects. So those are called the hydrosphere, the lithosphere, and the atmosphere. So all these different spheres of the Earth combine. And that's actually a very unusual thing in itself, because as a scientist, you'll be a scientist of one or the other. And the broad umbrella term for all these things is Earth scientist. So that's why, again, this multidisciplinary side really comes into play, because it's rare even in science. And that's what's taken me all the way from experiences with the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute as kind of a marine geologist to some experiences at NASA as well, where we're looking at kind of things in outer space and how things that we see on Earth have a tie-in with that. So yeah, it's, again, I don't think it's to do with just geology and ocean science. It's really when you bring together two completely different fields within the Earth sciences field itself, it's really a powerful thing.
Natasha, how important do you feel it is to kind of follow the path that you've followed, which is to create your own niche, where from the sounds of it, there are very few people in the world who can do what you do?
So the question is, how important it is to me on a personal level?
Yeah.
Okay. That's probably an interesting one. I'd probably flip it the other way around. I think that for me, it was how I could have the most impact. And again, choosing when you want to have a meaningful career is great. And lots of people do. But I was very focused on the fact that if I wanted to have impact, I can't just go into a field and kind of sit where everyone else sits and be kind of not really average, but just I really wanted to make a significant contribution in some way. And to be able to do that is very much, well, what sets you apart? And I think one of my abilities in the career that I'm known for is to be able to understand so many different things and to a very deep technical degree. So it's important to me because it enables me to be good at what I do, which therefore helps a lot of people. And then, I mean, we've talked a lot about science and kind of these geology and oceanography things and how this can tie together in terms of what it means. But how does that translate into the wider world? I mean, the work I do now, getting to advise governments on earth sciences, but specifically I'm a natural hazard expert at the moment. So anything from earthquakes, floods, and landslides, these types of things, if these events happen out specifically in South Asia at the moment, I'm the one that they kind of send in and will help governments either prepare for those things, or there's typically been a disaster and then I'll help them deal with it as well. And again, it's not just looking at, oh, there's been a flood or there's been a landslide. The real reason I'm there on the ground is because a flood has triggered a landslide, which has triggered potentially a debris flow or some other disaster. And it's this hazard chain that right now people are trying to get AI to model and things like that. But there's a small group of scientists that also kind of pioneered that research. And I'm very lucky to have been able to have learned from them and to just kind of help keep passing on knowledge that they've taught me. And that's why I'm where I am today, actually, because the scientists I work with, who I admire so much, they're very busy pushing the boundary of science that they don't get involved in this work. But I think it's so powerful and relevant to what we as a society need today in terms of facing climate change, that that's a space that I felt that our knowledge could really benefit. So I applied to the World Bank, which is where I currently work, and I'm not in their profile at all, actually. So it was very curious for me to see whether they would actually accept my expertise and knowledge and take me into the organization. Mm. And luckily they did. And actually that's been a whole thing in itself, because I'm now one of one at the World Bank in that sense, and their only expert in this specific thing, which is a very fortunate position to be in for myself personally. But in terms of now, again, having this impact, it's an incredibly lucky thing, and to be able to do every day as a job and to help, like I said, I specifically work in the South Asia region. The World Bank itself as an organization is a development organization. So they really are focused on helping developing countries progress in their goals and grow their economies and develop. So that's really important to me.
So you're looking at natural disasters. You've got skills and expertise in this area. You say that you're advising governments. If I've got my understanding right, whenever we watch a big movie like The Day After Tomorrow or 2012, I'm going back in time about 10 years now, you're that scientist that's relied upon to have all of the brains to provide the information, but half the time the general public don't listen to you. Is that right?
In a film, that's so interesting. I would say so, but to be fair, I'm, again, very lucky, because that part where the general public doesn't listen to me isn't really the kind of sphere I operate in. I'm really with the governments themselves, and then that's on them to kind of disseminate that to the general public, which is why it's so great.
Ah, okay. So in these movies, quite often the president doesn't listen, or the government officials don't listen. Maybe the president does listen, but his advisors or her advisors don't tend to listen. Is that the reality, though, or do you find that when you're advising, people do actually keep their eyes open to things that might happen, these natural disasters, which either have happened or might happen in the future?
Okay, so there's two parts to this question. The first is, when I'm advising any high-level government official or decision maker, whether they listen or not, the pressure and onus tends to be on them, because in the situation that I work, so I sit in what's called climate change and disaster risk management. That's the area that I work in at the moment in development. And what that means is that the types of scenarios I'm dealing with in current situations, often a lot of lives are at stake, or a lot of assets are at stake. So there's high financial, potentially high financial loss or loss of human life. So with me having this very unique expertise, typically the World Bank would like to kind of tread lightly, which I agree with, but I'm also very fortunate because I have to represent science and scientific truth of the situation. So I will go in there and lay it out very honestly to them and then say, this is my advice, take it or leave it. But, you know, I feel like I have a responsibility to the client country and the people that live within the country, not just to the governments themselves. So that's something in itself. This job's actually a diplomatic position. It's very much treading lightly in that sense. And again, at 29, I'm incredibly fortunate to be doing it. Yeah. But the second part of that question, when you said kind of what happens when the people don't listen, the World Bank itself is unusual because you have the United Nations, the World Bank, these kind of intergovernmental organizations that people have heard of before, but don't really know what happens. So the way I kind of explain it to people is that are very familiar with the United Nations is that the UN goes in and helps a lot of countries by facilitating things, and then they'll give aid. But the World Bank, because they give money and it's tied to trust fund money, so that essentially means that lots of different countries pay in to kind of a pool or a pot, and then that pot is kind of distributed amongst the least developed countries. So what that means is that when I go in and speak with the governments, some of that money is tied to my recommendations. So there is incentive for them to listen. And also I'm fortunate because I get to work with them to change legislation. So I'll often help them pass laws so that we'll facilitate things like climate science understanding and say, hey, you need to install more seismometers, which are instruments to measure seismic activity that ultimately tell us, you know, where we can expect earthquakes to happen and things like that. So it's really a full cycle job in all directions. And again, really, you can really kind of see now where this multidisciplinary kind of knowledge comes into play a lot in this job.
Yeah, I can fully understand now why the need for diplomacy is going to be so high with the work that you're doing. That's that's a side to your work that I had no consideration for before we started talking. This is incredible talking to you, Natasha. It really is. You mentioned earlier on about using AI to model some of these scenarios. How do you see AI changing our understanding of planet Earth, essentially, as we move into the future?
Oh, this is such a good question, because I was having this conversation the other day. There's so many different sides to AI. I mean, I'm going to touch on the very mainstream, I guess, part of this argument, which is lots of people are concerned about, you know, the ethics behind AI. But that, for me, is not even why I think people should be looking. I think that the argument with AI for me as an earth scientist is all to do with resources, and that's an angle people rarely touch on. So what I really mean by what I'm saying there is that in order to have AI be possible, we need very specific elements on Earth that we don't have a great number of. And this is very interesting because it ties into kind of energy security and how we look at petroleum and oil is finite, and it ties into seabed mining and how people think, okay, we've got all these electric cars, so there's all this cobalt and nickel on the seafloor, let's take it from there so that we don't run out. But no one's ever really been looking and saying, okay, so the chips we need to power AI supercomputers, and specifically their graphics cards, where are we getting that from? And the answer is that right now that there isn't enough, and that's why it's causing a supply chain issue. So we both cannot produce enough of the chips, and we can't produce them fast enough either. What that means currently is that the biggest players like Google and Microsoft are the ones being given the chips first, and smaller companies that arguably could make a much bigger contribution to AI, but specifically in my interest, the climate AI space, aren't being facilitated to do that. And it's a little bit the opposite side then, and kind of they're being shut out a little bit there. And then that has broader implications for knowledge. And I think that's interesting in many senses, because in my job at the bank, actually, so I've entered on a five-year contract at the minimum. So it's a five-year term where I have to do specific things to make change. And one of those things is really looking at my job as being a transformative role. So I come in, the bank is very much involved in development and spending money, making change. But the way I see it, and this is tied to AI, is that we've had the kind of the industrial revolution, and then we have the technological revolution. And then the third one, for me, is going to be a data and knowledge revolution. So I think that that's really interesting to see this role that AI is playing in that sense, because lots of people looking at it as in us versus AI, which is very valid. But I see it as well, how much like everything that we tend to do as a society and a human race is, how much is that is us conflicting with each other in this AI kind of AI arms race, essentially. And that's kind of what I'm keeping tabs on, because I think when I see things, being a multidisciplinary expert and seeing patterns, that's very interesting to me, because we're kind of heading for, very ironically, some sort of arguments is very much how we got into the climate change problem, right? We have a very finite set of resources. And then this ties into kind of healthcare and like nature versus nurture. So this is what we were kind of given, essentially our genetics and our starting point. And then the nature side, how do we use what we inherit? And that's very interesting. And people don't look at this in the broader sense. The climate change argument is so strong that people just see it as in, oh, we've got, you know, a lot of oil and we've used it all and we've kind of really destroyed the planet in doing so. And then the same pattern is happening in the AI space, and it's not really talked about. So that's my perspective on it, to answer your question in kind of a roundabout way there.
It's incredible. Now that you're introducing technology into the work that you're doing, we've got science, we've got diplomacy, we've got international relations, people management, and technology. It's incredible the work that you do. Natasha, if somebody is listening to this, maybe they're at Alice Smith right now, maybe they're age 16, 17, 18, something like that, and they're thinking about what they should be doing with their career, based on the fact that it was, what, 10, 11 years ago that you left there, what would you suggest to somebody is the right approach that they should take when they're thinking about their own career?
When I look at how it really happened for me, I think when I was in Alice Smith, I spent so much time doing a lot of sport, with it being a very sports-focused school. I really did it kind of every day, Monday to Friday. I was on all the teams and I loved it, to the point where my work not only suffered, I actually thought I wasn't very smart, to be honest. I definitely thought I was dumb because I just didn't get the grade. So I think what's interesting about that is being so sports focused, being kind of international level in the sports I did from a young age, really from 12 till 16, 17, which is arguably up until kind of sixth form at that point, it wasn't my focus at all. Then not getting the grades and realizing that when I went to university, I would have to work hard, A, because I didn't have an academic track record at this point, obviously. So I really needed to prove it to myself and actually get it on paper that I have, you know, maybe like a first or, you know, A star, whatever is the higher mark that's really going to show that you're going to be able to be competitive in the job market. And then in terms of actually being at university, when you take on the student loan, that's pressure in itself. You really have to make it count. It's a lot of debt to just be there, to be honest, and not be doing anything. That's the point where, as much as I say, hey, I didn't get the grades, look, my life turned out great, I would say to anyone, you have to get it together at university. I still had a great social life. I still was on those sports teams. But for example, I would do all my sports and I would come back at midnight and just work for 1 hour to 12 to 1 a.m. or I'd get up from 6 a.m. to 7 and I did an hour every day. And it made such a difference and enabled me to do all that stuff. And still, I graduated with a first. And realistically for me, whilst it looks cool and fun to say I didn't get the grades and still got there, getting the first at university was what enabled me to get my PhD. So it's very unusual to get a PhD fully funded by the UK government with just a bachelor's. But that's how it happened for me because I had the Geology with Ocean Science degree, which was very unique and specialized for the PhD that I'd like to do. In terms, again, of looking at how do you get to these points, I didn't know until I was going along this path, essentially, that this is what I wanted to do. There's lots of students, especially when you're mentioning the difference between America and England, especially in America, who prepare for these things very far in advance. I personally, not just because it's my own journey, but because I do believe in the merit behind it, I would advocate for really just making the decisions as you move through life and as these things come up. I think you can get a lot more out of it. And I think if you do that, you will surprise yourself and end up kind of far beyond where you would have expected for yourself. And I think that's the true power in it. It's very risky and it's very scary, but that's why I think it's worth it. And in terms of now, when we're looking at how did I bridge that university gap to the career then, we've talked a little bit about it, but perhaps not in such a focused way. So just keep it succinct and concise here. When you tie those things together, I think in the career sense, you're then looking at, I've put in all this effort. How am I going to make it count? And in my case, when you've got, I look at it everywhere that I've got to in my life has been through people that have been involved in it, whether it's my PhD supervisor or my friends and my family. They are people that have supported me along the way. So I also, it's a little bit of pressure, actually. If you do it right and all these people have supported and counted on you at the end, you're kind of thinking, how do I make it all worth it? And that for me was the best way to do this impact work and to work at the World Bank or the UN or wherever I was targeting. So again, that comes down to personal choices and things like that as well. But interestingly, that's none of which is grades or taking the right subjects and things like that that I've mentioned at all during this call. So yeah, it's definitely how I'd approach it.
Well, Natasha, I'm confident that we got the right person in this world of climate change and disaster risk management that you mentioned earlier. I could sit here and talk to you for twice as long as we have already, but I'm keeping an eye on time. We're going to need to bring this to a close. If anybody wanted to connect with you online, where would be a good place for them to do that?
Oof, I am terrible at all of the social media online things. I'm actually a bit difficult to get a hold of, to be honest. I travel a lot for work. So the best place is probably LinkedIn. I always tend to see my LinkedIn messages, even if it's a bit late, a couple of days late or a week late, I will reply. So I would say that that's really the only place I have at the moment. I do have an Instagram, but I'm not really on there. That was just for work. So I have an earth.scientist Instagram where I sometimes post maybe once or twice a year.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll put a link to your LinkedIn profile in the show notes for this episode. But in the meantime, Natasha Chaplow, it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Simon. Take care.
So there we are. That brings us to the end of this episode. If you have any questions at all, then please do get in touch with the school. But in the meantime, thank you for listening to this, and we'll see you next time. Bye for now.